From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
White yams with green garlic butter, aioli, pickled onion, hazelnut duca, celery. I don't know if I said celery.
That's Chef Jeremy Fox talking about one of my favorite dishes on the menu at Rustic Canyon in Santa Monica. The recipe's in Fox's new cookbook. It's his first, and it's called On Vegetables.
None of those ingredients is really all that exciting on its own. It's garlic, it's yams, it's celery, it's mayonnaise, you know, sesame seeds. But it was, how can this become this craveable thing that you eat once and you don't know why you like it? You kind of just deconstruct it as you go.
So talk to me about your initial coming together with Josh Loeb and Zoe Nathan, the owners of Rustic Canyon and many other restaurants that we love in Santa Monica. How did they approach you about working there?
We had met a few times. I really liked them. They were just really cool, normal, grounded people. And it was kind of at a time where I think Rustic Canyon was at somewhat of a crossroads, or, you know, there wasn't a chef. And I was also at a point where I didn't have a home, didn't know if I wanted a home. And it was just, I think, good timing. And there was a lot of honesty involved in like, can I actually do this? And I'm just really thankful that things went pretty much as well as things could have possibly gone. That doesn't usually happen.
No, it doesn't. The first recipe in your cookbook is a grilled cheese sandwich.
Right, yeah.
Why?
You know, I think people get this, an idea that vegetarian food, it can't be craveable. It can't be something that's satisfying. Everyone likes a grilled cheese. Like, it doesn't matter if you're a meat eater or a vegetarian. A cheesy, buttery, crispy, salty grilled cheese is just so satisfying. There's not even any vegetables in this dish, and the book's called On Vegetables. But it's just kind of the mentality that vegetarian food doesn't have to be less flavorful or less satisfying than anything else.
Speaking about being a kid, did you eat your vegetables as a child?
Not really. I would add chopped onions or bell peppers to a frozen pizza, like that sort of thing. But I do remember sitting at the dinner table for an hour because I wouldn't eat my Brussels sprouts. And granted, they weren't prepared very well. And, you know, I'm going to stick to my story on that, if they were, you know, there was some seasoning involved or some skill, you know, behind it. But there wasn't, so I didn't want to eat them. For so long, I hated Brussels sprouts. And I feel like, at least in my generation, a lot of people hated Brussels sprouts as a kid. Now, Brussels sprouts are one of the most popular. Like, if you have it on a menu, that's all you're going to sell in it. And it's a huge seller.
It's bizarre.
Mm-hmm. But I feel like, yeah, my generation growing up, like, there were just nightmares about Brussels sprouts.
I remember putting the Brussels sprouts in my napkin and sneaking them into the backyard and throwing them across the hedge to the neighbor's backyard.
Trying to get the dog to eat them from under the table when no one's looking.
Adjacent to Brussels sprouts are peas. And just from looking in the book, it's obvious that you love peas, and you have several recipes for them. Take me through a couple, just so we can see how your brain works.
It's funny, you know, you say that it's obvious I like peas, because probably up until I was maybe 22, I couldn't stand peas. You know, if I got fried rice, it would literally just be left in the bottom of the container or bowl would just be peas. Like, I would not eat them. That's because they were always frozen peas. Like, I eventually had fresh English peas out of the pod, and it's like, oh, these are great. The physical nature of the peas, I started to look at kind of like I did with pigs, of using every part. And I think the feeling of embarrassment, of not feeling I'm clever enough to use something, to have to throw something away.
Like the pod.
Like the pods. You know, there's a few dishes with peas in the book. One is peas with white chocolate and macadamia, which was kind of a signature dish at Ubuntu that, you know, I do occasionally on like special events. But
so I just have to stop you in terms of, you just say that sentence so quickly, you know, peas with white chocolate and macadamia nuts. What in your brain made you want to pair peas with white chocolate?
At the time, it was based on white chocolate macadamia nut cookies, which I had like a little bit of an obsession with. And I don't necessarily remember exactly why I thought it would work, but I think there were a few incarnations on the way to get it to that point. I think there may have even been a sweet version before that, that segued into a savory version.
So you did almost a bar cookie with peas and
In the book, yeah, there's a blondie with the macadamia nuts and then like an English pea en glaze to serve with it. You double shuck the peas, meaning you shuck them out of the pods, you blanch them lightly, and then you squeeze each pea. And out of each pea are two little halves. The outer, I call it the husk, And it's like, well, I've done this and I'm getting a small yield, so it's kind of irresponsible for me to not at least figure out another use for it. You can take those little husks, puree them, a little bit of olive oil, and you have this pea puree that still tastes like peas. And then we use that in a dish based on a Risi Bisi, where it's like a rice porridge. You throw that pea husk puree in there, and then you have another dish, another utilization for that byproduct. And then the pods, there's a few different preparations, whether it's just infusing kind of this tea or consomme that gets poured over the peas and white chocolate, or they get smoked, and it takes on the flavor of like a split pea soup. And then if you thicken that with other vegetables, carrots, grilled bread to kind of get this kind of flavor profile that I was trying to achieve for what my grandmother made, you know, it's not a pretty thing. But split pea soup is usually this drab green, but it is basically a split pea soup made, you know, without any peas. It's just throwaways.
Given that you get to have this sort of unfettered access to the best vegetables that come into the city, do you have a favorite season? And do you have a vegetable that you think is really underrated that you want us to take under our wings?
The last few months, I've moved away from my celery obsession, and it's onto dill. I love dill on everything right now. It started at this restaurant called Raffi's in Glendale that I had never even heard of, and I live not far from there.
It's Armenian-Iranian, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So good. They're kebabs.
Yeah. I looked in the kitchen. It was just these crazy grills for the kebabs. It's really impressive. And I had this dish, which, you know, I might butcher the pronunciation, but bagali polo.
Bagali polo.
Bagali polo.
Yeah.
And it was this rice dish. It was lima beans, fava beans, and just lots of dill. I always just associated dill with smoked salmon and cucumbers. Like, that's pretty much it. That was on a Sunday. I think by Wednesday, I had a take on this dish on the menu at Rustic, and because it was lima bean season, fresh lima beans from McGrath, and now that dish is back on the menu with fava beans. But it's, you know, it's more of like a rice porridge with, you know, tons of dill, garlic confit, and then we serve it with a confit lamb neck.
Wonderful. Jeremy Fox's new cookbook is called On Vegetables. You'll find a recipe for his peas, white chocolate, and macadamia on our website. Next, we look at the salad as a way into the artist's mind. Stay with us. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. Artists and salad. Who would imagine that this odd mashup would be such a powerful lens with which to explore the creativity of humble humans? Julia Sherman professes that good art should make the everyday seem at once familiar and strange. Her photography-based blog is Salad for President. She's created salads with painters, musicians, and architects. Her book of the same name is both powerful and hilarious.
Hi, Evan.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. So first I have to ask you, whose recipe is the salad? Is it yours or the artist's?
It really depends. My goal is always to draw something out of the guest. So it usually starts with a conversation over email or over the phone. We try to get to the heart of the matter. Like, everybody kind of has a salad that is either something they think they do well, something that they really love, something that they'd like to improve upon. You know, there's been some exceptions. I think William Wegman was definitely one exception. But in general, I really try to start with the artist. And then I come to their house and we make the food. And then I take the recipe home and I really develop it and make it into something that my readers can share and replicate at home.
So, I mean, it goes without saying that the recipes just look fabulous. But the encounter with the people is just so wonderful, and the way it unfolds as you share the interviews with us in a print format along with photographs of being with them in the studio is so interesting. How much do you think that you're able to get out of these encounters because you have sort of the salad to lubricate it?
Yeah, I mean, I think about this a lot because I'm not trained as a journalist. I'm a photographer and an artist myself. So the way that I'm relating to my subject is really just as, someone who's on a blind date with a really demanding criteria. So, you know, even though salad is something that's relatively easy to do compared to, you know, if this was a blog about baking or pot roast or something. It's not a huge ask compared to other food categories, but it is a big ask to show up at a stranger's house and ask them to create a meal for you, ask them to let you take their picture. And generally these things take about 4 or 5 hours because they kind of get away from us and they're pretty fun. So for me, using salad as a gateway or an entree into somebody's world, into their home, it disarms them, and it definitely makes people ready to open up because they're really focused on the task at hand. I find for most of us, once we're using our hands and we're focused on making a meal, we're kind of instantly at ease and everything sort of unfolds from there.
And that unfolding and the sense of intimacy and really entering a private space is really apparent in the book. Let's pick some of your subjects, your guests. Let's start with Harry Gessner. Tell us who he is.
So Harry Gessner is my big crush. He is a 90-something-year-old architect. He's also an inventor. He's a war hero. He's really a larger-than-life character. So I encountered him for the first time after seeking him out and trying to get an invite to his house in Malibu. And I was not familiar with his work before I did a project at the Getty Museum last year where I created a salad garden in their sculpture garden. And when I was doing my first site visits at the Getty and looking for the proper place to install the garden, we went behind this row of bushes and trees, and they showed me this house that was the original home that existed on the Getty campus before the museum was built. Anyone who's been to the Getty knows that it's the most remote place in LA in the middle of the city that feels like perched on a hilltop. And it's hard to imagine anything being there before the museum. But there was actually this very modest home that was Harry Gessner had built for a man named Mr. Scantlin. And it was his bachelor pad, and it had a pool that you could swim into the living room through a waterfall, and that created an airlock between the outside and the inside. And when you get inside, it was a fern garden. It was kind of like a cave, like a mid-century cave with these sweeping views of the city, all glass, two fireplaces, and a tiny, tiny little kitchen. Once I saw that house, I really fell in love with it, and it just seemed like such an incredible gem that was hidden, but kind of in plain sight as well. So my first proposal for the garden was to put the garden in the drained swimming pool, which of course was not accepted. From there, we ended up moving the garden just down the hill. But I, at that moment, knew that I needed to find Harry Gessner. So I got in touch with him, and he invited me over. About an hour or two in, I'm standing on his kitchen counter. He's, for some reason, had a chef's hat. He's wearing a chef's hat. We're taking all these pictures. He's showing me old photos of his wife and his family and his adventures and Marlon Brando and all of these crazy things that he had done throughout his life. And we were really having a good time. And at that point, he realized that he was completely unsure of who I was. He actually thought that I was an architectural historian who had also emailed earlier that week about wanting to get access to the Getty Scantlin house and asking him if they could come to his house to learn more about it and to meet with him. So this whole time I'm in his house and he's making me salad and we're taking all these photos, he's wondering why this architectural historian is so obsessed with salad and why this is part of the necessary process of talking about his career. So, you know, something like that was like just a really amazing experience to think that somebody would be so open to do this with a total stranger with having no idea why, you know?
The images are fabulous. The one of him working on the salad with the chef's hat on is just marvelous. And the one with you and he sitting with gas masks on, dealing with horseradish, it's fantastic. Talk a bit about the horseradish and the gas masks.
So when I was at his house, I was really determined to fold him into the Getty project somehow, and I was building a salad garden there, and, you know, it wasn't in the swimming pool, but it was just down the hill. So I wanted to figure out a way that we could work together. So I asked him if he ever gardened, and he said that on D-Day, he almost lost his legs, and he was on a boat home, and he found a book about medicinal plants, and he read that book from cover to cover, and he became really interested in medicinal plants and horseradish in particular. And he said he was going to come home and he was going to grow himself horseradish. So he did that, not knowing that horseradish is, you know, somewhat invasive. And he ended up having this garden in his house that was entirely made of horseradish. And so every year he would harvest it, and his family would have to leave for 48 hours, and he would just put on his gas mask that I guess he had from the war, and he would process all of this horseradish, bottle it up, and then give it all away. So this was, to me, just an incredible ritual that was really quite labor-intensive. Again, seemed like only an artist would do something like this. I loved that, and I asked him if he still had the garden, and he said no, he didn't anymore, and I told him I would grow him horseradish at the Getty, and I asked him if he would come back and teach me how to make his horseradish at the Scantlin house, which he hadn't been back to in, I think, like 30 years. So when the horseradish was ready to be harvested, we made a video together, and I invited him back, and we picked it. We went back into the house, and, you know, we revisited and walked through that space, and then we put some gas masks on, and we made a whole bunch of horseradish.
Tell me what that his particular salad was.
That was an example of somebody saying to me, I'm 93, like, can you just get the groceries and tell me what we're making? So I just went to the Santa Monica Farmers Market and got fresh dates. And he had told me he loves almonds. And I got Marcona almonds and some watercress. And we just made a really simple salad. And it was really nice because he loves food, but he had never seen fresh dates before. So I got to introduce a new ingredient to him. Something that he was really excited about learning how to use.
Okay, so that's one portrait. Let's talk about a completely different one. For this one, you actually went to Japan to the home of a very private artist, Yui Sugimura.
Yeah, so I had heard a story from another artist recently who had told me about this region in Nara where they're really famous for their pottery and their ceramics. And he told me about this story that a curator had taken him into the woods to the ceramicist's home, and the ceramicist there is considered a national treasure. So they actually label people national treasures in Japan, artists. So he was doing this very traditional form of pottery, and the artist I was speaking with went, and he was taken up into his home in the mountains, and there, leading up into the house, there were just shards of pottery everywhere, and the whole landscape was made of that, and it was kind of woven into the woods, and he just described this meal they had that was so beautiful and incredible, and he told me, well, you really can't do that because, you know, I was taken by someone special, and really nobody gets to do it. Somehow I figured out how. So another friend of mine who came, an artist named Brie Rue, she came with me. She's a ceramic artist. And we were traveling through Japan together, and we got in touch with the curator. And the curator took us to a few artist studios. And one of those artists was not the artist that we had been told about before, but his son. So it was a totally similar situation, same kind of ceramics, same landscape. They built the house together. And again, it was this big wood-fired kiln. And all of the shards of pottery were just like dotting the landscape. And as you approached, it was like you were on the moon. So Yui Sugimura's work is, it uses some of the traditional styles, but it's actually considered to be very radical in comparison to his predecessors and his father in particular. But it's made from this really beautiful mineral-rich clay that the region is famous for. And it's a long wood firing where they throw ash into the kiln overnight, and the ash adheres to the surface of the clay and draws all the natural minerals to the surface and makes this kind of beautiful blue-green, like intergalactic ceramic quality. So, yeah, so I went to his house, and he didn't speak any English, and his gallerist brought us, and he made this beautiful persimmon caprese salad in his bowls, and those same bowls that we had seen in the beautiful gallery the morning before we visited a solo show. That was what he served us the food in, and that was what his dog drank out of, and that was what, you know, they had propping up the trash can. So the ceramics were really just kind of incorporated into every touch point of his world. Eating together was a really special experience because we got to actually eat off of his work.
I have to ask you one more question about the photographs. there are so many dogs, people's pets. Some of the images of how you capture somebody like an older woman artist in a 1940s style apron with her dog just in the background going after a ball.
I think in some ways the dog thing is similar to the way salad kind of crept up on me in my life. I mean, I've always made salad, grown salad, and then all of a sudden it kind of took center stage for me. And in making this book, it wasn't until we were finished with the layout that my editor said, "Okay, Julia, enough with the dogs." And I said, "Wait, what are you talking about?" She was like, "Wait, you don't realize?" And I hadn't realized that I had shot almost nearly every artist with their dog. I mean, William Wegman is an obvious example. Somehow my portraits of these people or of their lives, you know, their pets really became a part of that. You know, I really love animals, but I also think that it's part of understanding, you know, somebody's lifestyle and their day-to-day and the things that really matter to them. So if I'm moving around someone's interior space and I'm looking for what to shoot that really speaks to who they are, you know, their pets speak to who they are as much as their furniture, you know, or their decor or their artwork or whatever. So I don't know, maybe my next book will be about dogs.
Dogs and their foods.
Right.
Well, thank you so very much, Julia.
Thank you, Evan. I really appreciate it.
Julia Sherman's new book and her blog are called Salad for President. In a minute, we continue our meatless meal. That's when the show continues. Don't turn that dial. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm on the phone right now with Deborah Madison. In the 1980s, her restaurant Greens changed the way many of us saw vegetable cookery. Her latest book is In My Kitchen, and it's all about, you guessed it, cooking with vegetables. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
There's something about the term vegetarian cooking that I kind of recoil from.
Yes, me too.
Because it's so laden with bad things. What have you learned about vegetable-focused cooking over the years?
Well, I mean, one thing I've learned in the sense that I've seen is that, and I think you already alluded to it, is that people don't have to work so hard to defend, you know, how they eat if they choose not to eat meat, because it's just another option. There are meatless Mondays. If you go to a certain kind of restaurant, there may be a vegetarian or a meatless dish, you know, to choose from for your entree, which might simply sound a little more exciting than the usual to somebody. But they don't have to fear that they're going to be called a vegetarian because they've chosen it. It's just food. It's another way.
Getting into the kitchen and looking at that question from a more technical viewpoint, I know that you would advocate growing your own vegetables, definitely if you don't do that, to know your producers. But what about culinary techniques or ingredients really leap out to you as a recommendation for us to up our game?
Oh, boy, you ask the hard questions because I just go into my kitchen and cook. But I'll tell you what, I mean, I do have a few things I feel strongly about, and I don't know that they're culinary techniques, but I think it's really, really important to give yourself plenty of space to work and to work with a sharp knife. I sometimes see people working on these tiny little boards that were probably meant for cheese and came as a wedding gift or something. And what you really want is a lot of space. Vegetables take a lot of space. There's a lot of stuff you're going to disregard and throw away, you know, or compost if you're cooking with vegetables. It's just the way they are. Using good salt is important to me. Ingredients are always the most important thing because they can lead a dish in so many different ways, or they can devastate a dish if they're not good.
Help us think about how to put together a menu so that we don't only have to rely on a bowl where the entire menu is just stacked on top of each other.
I actually kind of have a special loathing in my heart for bowls. And So I never make a bowl unless it's for soup, you know. But, well, I did find that at my restaurant, Greens, because we had so many customers, and this was the early days of vegetarian cooking, and when men were dragged in by their wives on the weekend and you knew they were looking forward to a steak and dreading what they were going to get, you know, I had to have something in the center of the plate for the eye to go to and to be it. And those dishes tended to be complicated. They were folded, they were stacked, they were layered. Something had been done to give food the kind of focus that meat would have had. Today, I think there's just a lot of different ways to make a menu. It can be a mezze kind of menu with lots of different little tastes. It could be nothing more than soup and a salad, maybe a dessert. As I say in the book, there are many times when my idea of dinner is rested very firmly on a baked sweet potato and a salad, and that's fine. And I think we can eat a lot more simply and not have to apologize for it.
Let's talk about a soup. You have a Japanese sweet potato soup. We're really lucky out here at the farmers market. A few farmers are growing incredible Japanese sweet potatoes. So give us an idea.
Well, I love that soup. And it's interesting you brought it up because I've just been making it a lot the last few weeks. Actually, and not using Japanese sweet potatoes because I couldn't find them. So I just used the garnets. And when I first started making a sweet potato soup with Japanese sweet potatoes, which I love because of their kind of chestnutty flavor, I thought, I'm going to try a totally different flavor profile that's not ginger, which is very natural and normal with sweet potatoes. So I made a soup, I can't remember it now, but with rosemary and, you know, with maybe brown butter or something. And in the end, I loved it, but I swear I could taste ginger. So this soup, I just decided to put ginger in and coconut milk. And yeah, I just went back in that direction more. But then I finished it with a little smoked salt to bring to the table. And if you have a few drops of a really good balsamic vinegar, that kind of wakes the whole thing up. And it's really nice. But sometimes I don't have that vinegar and I leave it out and it's still a good soup. But I love the coconut milk with sweet potatoes, ginger. I think those are all very compatible flavors.
So staying with the coconut milk for a minute, you have a recipe that I suspect is like one of those recipes that has very few ingredients but is better than the sum of its parts. It's collards with coconut milk and shallots.
Oh, yeah. I started growing collards because I got so discouraged by the collards we could buy here, which are like huge and tough and leathery, and they're easy to grow. And I was cooking them in coconut oil, and then I thought, you know, the coconut flavor is good here, and why not braise them a little bit in some coconut milk? And I did that, and I liked the flavor of it. And I went back to look through some Indian cookbooks much later, and I found, oh, that's how they cook collard greens often. It may be a little more complicated as a kind of a curry or a vegetable dish, but the coconut and collards is surprisingly good.
So many of us grew up thinking that cheese soufflés were like the super fancy dinner party dish that you would only make if you had time and were willing to fail. But you call your cheese soufflé your go-to dish.
It is. I mean, they are so easy. They really, really are. I think we've tackled so many more difficult things, you know, in our culinary lives than cheese soufflés. In fact, that's the dish that got me interested in cooking when I was 16. It's just such a wonderful dish. It's so dramatic. And hey, if it doesn't rise all the way or look as grand as you think it should be, it's fine. It's just going to be fine. And they're fragrant. They're glamorous looking. I don't use a big, tall souffle dish. I tend to bake mine in a more shallow earthenware dish because that way there's lots of crust. They cook very quickly. Everybody loves to dig in and get that golden top part anyway, so why not?
What would you pair that with a menu?
Oh, heavens. I think it really is going to depend on the time of year. To me, a souffle is going to stand by itself. It doesn't really need anything else on the plate, but you might start with a soup. You might end with a salad. You might have an introductory vegetable dish with some roasted peppers, maybe with some lentils, or a more complex and hefty salad like a black rice salad with golden beets and orach. And, you know, I think you can go in lots of directions. But I usually like the souffle just to stand by itself because it's exciting. People like it.
Okay, so now I have to ask you a question that sounds almost political, but where do you stand on hummus?
Hummus is the Arabic word for chickpeas, so I think it should be made with chickpeas. And I'm very traditional about it. I think if you make a traditional hummus and you serve it just a little bit warm and you garnish it beautifully, in my experience, people are wowed. They say, wow, what is that? And you just say, it's hummus, you know? And you go to the store and there's just everything under the world, you know, sriracha and green chili hummus and this and that. And I've been to so many parties where people just take it cold out of a carton and plop it on a plate if they do that. So I think it's actually really worth making and making it very traditionally.
You talk about in the book that it's difficult to figure out what people value in their cooking these days. Could you elaborate a bit?
Oh, I do get confused because we seem to be running in opposite directions as fast as we can. You know, on the one hand, you have takeout. It's just multiplied. In Santa Fe, our Whole Foods remodeled its whole store, and it's like tripled its amount of takeout at the expense of other foods that you might actually take home and cook. There's a great interest in cooking. There seems to be a great interest in cooking. And at the same time, there's a great interest in ordering meals that come in a box and they're all prepped and you put them together. And I'm not really sure what it is people want always and what they're doing, but I find cooking is important. I find it's kind of a relief to go in the kitchen and do something with your hands.
Deborah Madison is the author of In My Kitchen. Last year, she was inducted into the James Beard Foundation Cookbook Hall of Fame. Now let's see what Laura Avery is shopping for at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. I'm guessing it's something popping with flavor.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. So happy to be seeing Evan Funky, who's been a regular at the market since 2008. He's back again. He's got his new restaurant, Felix, on Abbott Kinney. And you are shopping for something springy, I'm assuming. What are you looking for?
Good morning. Spring is in full swing. It's absolutely bursting this morning with all of those rites of spring, fava beans, peas, artichokes. So it's only natural that in La Cucina Romana, the quintessential spring dish, la vignarola, which is peas, fava beans, artichokes, the holy trinity of spring.
Now, the fava beans are a very, very labor-intensive crop. You have to peel them, and then you got the bean inside, and then you peel that. But at a certain age, can't you just eat the whole thing?
Absolutely. If they're young, you can eat them. Once they come out of the pod, you can eat the skin on it. And in fact, most of Italy eats the bean with the skin on. They also like to roast them in the pod and serve them with a piquant pecorino stagionato. It's absolutely fabulous.
But then you have to pop them out of the skin.
You do.
Yeah.
You do. But it's just technique.
I like the way you hand that off to your customers to do. That's a good idea. Good call. Okay, and then the English peas, they require some shelling.
They do. English peas, most of the English peas in the market right now are young with just a little bit of weathering to them. I'm finding most of them are very, very sweet. There are some with high starch content, so you want to look out for those really big pods. Want to choose pods that look shiny and have small peas inside, and just taste some peas. Ask your farmer, hey, can I taste some? And that way you get a good sense of what's on the table. That's the best way. When I come here, I eat the market. I'm constantly eating. From one end to the other, and that way I know. And no one's going to tell you not to eat their produce. It's just a sample. So that's the best way to know whether the peas are starchy, whether they're amazing.
Okay, and then for the sugar snap peas, those, the ones I've tasted have that string. You like snap
yes.
off the calyx and then pull, and then two little strings come off.
Yes, there's a string from the top connected to the actual vine, and then the string at the bottom, which is a little hook.
Mm-hmm.
You just need the string both sides, and then they're completely edible.
And you do that in your kitchen before you prepare them?
Absolutely.
Okay, do you have minions?
I have many minions, but I'm not above shucking peas or peeling artichokes or anything like that. That's my joy in life.
Yeah, and I love how the peas come. You can see the cap where it's attached to the plant, and then you see that little withered little bloom on the end, and that's how you know they're like super
glorious.
Fresh.
Isn't that glorious?
All the stages, yeah. So then you assemble all these lovely greens.
Yes, so we roast the artichokes. We blanch very quickly the fava beans and peas. We also roast some spring onions, which are available at a multitude of farms today. And then mix it with a little bit of lemon juice, olive oil, some sea salt, black pepper. And that's really it. You can add some mint, some parsley, basil, lightly cook, dress it. It can be room temperature. It can be hot. It can be as a stew. At Felix, we're serving it over house-made ricotta, olive oil, and sea salt. Serve with some grilled bread, rub with garlic. I mean, you can't get better than that.
Oh. And when you say roast the artichoke, are you starting with the boiling it first? How are you roasting a whole artichoke?
There's 10 ways to skin a cat. So peel the artichokes until you see that the yellow on the interior of the artichoke is halfway up. Trim the top, peel the stem, blanch them until they're tender, and then you can roast them in the oven. They're delightful that way. Or you can roast them all the way in a 350-degree oven until they're tender. They're glorious that way. You can also shave them raw. You can grill them. Artichokes are very, very versatile.
And there's no choke yet?
No choke. You want to take a look at the size and also give the artichokes a little bit of a squeeze. If you feel at the base that the base is very hard and then just above the choke, you feel that it's soft, you know that there's a choke inside of it. You really want to look for a very tight and firm head.
Okay, Evan, well, this is great. It's a super celebratory dish. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was Chef Evan Funke. He is chef owner of his new restaurant, Felix, which is located on Abbot Kinney. And Evan's been coming to the market for years, and we're so happy to see him back here and working on his new restaurant. I'm talking now with Luis Jaime from JF Organic Farm, and beautiful vegetable stand here at the market. I couldn't help but notice as I walked by, you have the spring onion, and it has the bloom on top. It's called an onion scape. So can you tell us about what stage of growth they're in at this point?
When they start getting the blossom, we usually have to cut it in order for the bulb to form. But since a lot of restaurants is asking us for the blossoms, for whatever we can get our blossoms and hands on, so we leave a whole row with the blossoms. And we'll be getting just the blossom by itself, but right now we have so many, so we brought the actual onion with the blossom attached to it.
Okay, and it will turn into a regular white or yellow onion?
Red. They'll grow to a pound or 2 pound onion. Sweet onions, red onions, yellow onions.
So the blossom, it's like this long stem and this big white puffy ball on top. Is that something that the chefs are cooking and eating?
Actually, yeah, they sprinkle them on their salad, and it has a really strong onion taste.
And so like most farmers, you plant in succession, like every couple of weeks, so you're going to have a steady supply of this? Are you going to be having these for a while?
Onion blossoms, yeah. Well, we plant a lot of them. We just planted the season for the dried onions. We planted about 40,000 plants on the weekend. That was our Easter weekend.
Oh.
But as far as the other blossoms, they usually end when it starts getting too hot. So once, end of May, all the blossoms are done.
So, Luis, when you're bringing in these, are you, like, thinning between the onions so some will stay and get big, but you can, meanwhile, pull these out to give the onions more room to form?
We used to. Now we actually plant them nice spacing to get the onion. But since we are very popular with all the blossoms, we leave one row of everything just go into blossoms. We just don't even harvest it.
Tell us a little bit about the other blossoms. You've got so many things blooming on your table. You've got bok choy blossoms, radish blossoms, black kale blossoms, something called choy sum, and then, of course, the arugula flowers, which I think we're all familiar with. But all these things are flowering, and nobody used to bring these in before.
It was a few years ago, I think, when my mom actually, the one that started going into the farm and picking a few flowers, brought them back to the farm. That was like 10 years ago. And then she brought it to the back of the stand. Chefs actually saw them, and it started getting popular as the time passed by. By now, I mean, as I told you, we grow one row of everything and let it grow into blossoms.
Just for the blossoms.
Blossoms.
Well, they're beautiful, and it's just fun to look at them. So good job bringing in something new that you probably can't get anywhere else.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes.
All right. Thank you, Luis.
Thank you.
That was Luis Jaime. He's the farmer at JF Organic Farms, and they have such a creative way of featuring the things in bloom, the actual blooms themselves. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Next up, we talk to a young woman who's been illustrating each of our shows this year. Stay with us. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. A few months ago, I was checking out my Instagram feed, and I noticed I'd been tagged, so I clicked and saw something pretty wild. Artist Stacy Michelson had illustrated that week's Good Food show. The whole show, in adorable pictures, even the difficult subjects. She did it not only that week, but she's been doggedly putting pen to paper to every single show since the beginning of the year. Michelson also designed a Good Food tote bag for us, depicting an avocado in a headband, a squash in shades, and condiment characters. Hi, Stacy.
Hi, how are you?
So was this your long game to start?
To get into KCRW Studios? Yes. Let's be honest, yes. And meet Martha Stewart. Is she here?
No,
I don't know. Okay, dang.
I have to say that we were just like, wow, really?
What, to illustrate the episode?
Yeah, the episode illustrations. Maybe you could take us through what one looks like, because what you're doing is you're bringing the show to life.
Yeah, and I feel like a lot of people don't know the show, and I always talk about it. So when I draw something, like one time you had a recipe for a sweet potato, and you were like, ooh, with, you know, butter, with lime zest. And I was in bed, and I was eating breakfast, and I was drinking coffee, and I was like, I want to make that. So I drew a little sweet potato, and of course mine has eyes and a mouth. And then I put the butter on that, wrote the little recipe that you said. And then when I'm looking back for, you know, ideas, it's like, oh, Evan's sweet potato. I had a bunch of those in sketchbooks, and I just thought, why don't I do a whole show one day, and maybe I'd tag you guys, like, if I was brave enough, and then maybe you'd like it. Then I gave myself the assignment to do it every weekend this year.
What I find so interesting is you include everything. So even the material that's more difficult, like mm-hmm. the sustainability piece, you'll have like little fish floating around.
Yeah.
And then a caption.
Yeah. Well, I try to pull out like the meat of the episode. So when I'm listening to it, there'll be certain parts where I think, oh, I can draw that. And it would come across really good. Like if somebody sees it on my Instagram, they don't need to listen to the show. All of a sudden they know about seafood sustainability, or they know about dumplings or types of tofu because I've just drawn this little picture. And I feel like it's a simple, quick way to do it. Some things are harder than others, of course, to illustrate. And I kind of just like think, does that make it on the page this week?
Cannibalism.
Yeah, that's hard. I did that one, and I kind of just took out the pieces that were, like, using it for medicine, using it for burial, you know, instead of a burial, different things like that, and tried not to be too gross. When I do Google stuff, sometimes it's like I become an expert on it, and the cannibalism thing, I was like, maybe I don't need to dive deep into this one.
How did you get into illustrating food?
When I went to Japan for the first time when I was 18, it changed my perspective on, like, packaging and just using characters to sell things. There's just cute stuff, you know, on all the packages. It makes me want to buy something that I don't even need or want or eat. But just because it's cute, I'm very food obsessed. So I'm always drawing food, and then it's personified food, usually with faces and personalities. And I don't know, I'm just always thinking about food, and I'm always drawing. I'm talking on the phone, and I look down, and I have all these funny coffee cups or pieces of avocado or chips. I'm like, okay, I think I'm hungry.
That's how I feel doing the show.
Yeah.
Has your illustration style always been the personification of objects?
I think so. Yeah, I've worked in restaurants for a long time, and I used to always be nominated to do the menu board, or like, hey, we have a special space, you draw, can you do this? And so I'd always do that. And then it kind of shifted into where I was saying, you know, our kids' menu is a little bland, we should probably redo it, here's an idea I had. And then, you know, somebody would buy that off me and that kind of thing. And I feel like the funnier and the cuter the food, the more people like it and the more people identify with it. And I don't know, you could have a drawing of an avocado, or you can have an avocado with a face and a sweatband, and now it's cool.
The avocado's awesome on
it's
the
funny,
tote
right?
bag. It's so funny. So this tote bag.
Yes.
We came to you mm-hmm. and we said, hey, you know, you're doing all of these illustrations. Would you be interested in making a tote bag for us? What immediately went through your mind? Because the end result, I should say, is, well, on one side, it's KCRW, which is a cast of condiment characters. Mm-hmm. And then the other side is...
That's the serious side.
Yeah. That is the serious side. The unserious side is basically a signboard made up of individual foods holding up each letter that spells out good food.
Yeah. I always go to farmers markets. I live in Atwater Village, and that has a really good farmers market. And then I went to the Women's March, and with all those signs, I feel like that kind of, you know, worked its way into one of my weekly illustrations with the chilies. And it was everybody holding signs about, you know, what the chilies represented and what kinds of chilies. And so then I thought, with the tote bag design, farmer's market, like, what do we want? How do we want it? We want good food. You know, like, what do you believe in? Good food. And so all these guys are saying, hey, do it.
They're so funny. They really are adorable. And everybody here,
thank you.
Everybody here has a favorite.
I feel like the crook neck squash is my favorite because the LA necklace, the pink shades.
And, you know, I go back and forth between the avocado and the pepper. The pepper,
yeah.
He's just dry.
Yeah, he's the older guy that listens to NPR. Maybe, you know, maybe
yeah,
he's
kind of... Yeah, he's got a mustache.
Yeah.
But he's, you know, he's carrying a sign.
Yeah. Well, he's ready to march. I mean, there's old guys at the march that I saw.
So you're a vegan.
Correct. True story.
How long?
20 years.
Wow, that's commitment.
Yeah.
Is it weird for you to draw meat? Do you personify meat in the same way? Can you?
I will, yeah. I don't think it's weird. I've gotten that question. I feel like on Instagram, a lot of my followers are either people that like my brand or people that like food, and a lot of them happen to be vegans. So when they're seeing certain things, they're like, oh, how did you draw that? And honestly, it's not weird for me. I mean, I know people eat meat. I just happen to not eat meat. But I do eat versions of those things. Like, my company has a pizza pin with pepperonis on it, and people are always like, that's so cute, but you don't eat that. But I do eat that, just a vegan version of that. So I look at food and I just think of it in the way that I eat it. Not, you know, it doesn't have to be that kind of bacon, like, oh, it's vegan bacon.
What are your favorite vegan places to eat in LA?
I love Pine and Crane. I love to go there, especially because a lot of my friends aren't vegan. So going to a place where it's not necessarily a vegan restaurant, I feel like that's always a good choice, especially for groups. They have, you know, noodles there, spicy peanuts, cold little deli case of like Chinese five spice bamboo shoots, gingered little lotus, things like that. I love that. I love Barama. I know you've had Joseph on the show. Love that place. And I don't know if you've had, they have a cashew poblano queso.
So good.
I feel like that stands up to real queso. I mean, my brain is warped. I don't know what real cheese tastes like at this point, but I feel like that dish is really good. He does vegetables really well. And, you know, you don't feel weird when you're going to a place like that. You have a cocktail, you get chips and, you know, cheese dip and...
But over the last 20 years, you've basically seen the evolution of what's out there. It's changed totally.
Yeah, I don't just want to eat salads minus this, and sub the dressing anymore. But
And
you
don't have to.
Yeah. And I love Burger Lords in Chinatown. They have regular beef burgers, and then they have a vegan burger. They have loaded fries with, you know, the grilled onions, the cheese, Thousand Island dressing. I love ice cream. Van Leeuwen. That's a great place. I feel like they have more vegan options than any place in town. I love Pizzanista for pizza. You can go in, get a vegan slice. I feel like LA is so easy, like when it comes to eating vegan food. And you don't just have to go to, you know, a health food restaurant. You know, you don't have to go to the place that has everything that I ate 15 years ago. Like, I want to go to the place that you go to, that you guys talk about on the show.
Have you been to Irvin yet?
I have. I've only been there once, so I couldn't put it as a favorite, but I do think that's a nice place, and I think he's doing good food. I like Crossroads, too. I love Crossroads when somebody else is paying, because that could definitely add up. That's a nice, like, date place or special occasion. I mean, it's nice that those places exist. The craveable stuff, I think, is Barama, Pine and Crane, Burger Lords, Hugo's Tacos. That's like, you know, fast food place where you can go get a torta and tamales.
Wow, what a great list.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. It was great to be here.
Find out how you can get Stacy Michelson's Good Food Tote Bag on our blog. Go to blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. There's also a list of where to try out our favorite Taiwanese snacks in LA, from soup dumplings to stinky tofu. Check it out. We close out the show with a restaurant review from our old pal, Jonathan Gold. Where are we headed this week?
We are going to the Arts District. We are going to Manuela inside the sprawling Hauser Wirth Gallery.
So interesting. All these different centers that are put together in a new way.
Yeah, and this is a building you've walked by for like 1,000 years and probably never thought twice about it. I guess it was built as a flour mill 100, 120 years ago. Now it's art galleries. It's the size of a museum. And there's a restaurant in it that's huge, but in the context of this complex, it almost looks tiny.
What kind of food are we eating?
Southern food. I'm not sure whether it's ironic Southern food or unironic Southern food, but it's pretty good. It's a chef, Wes Witzel, who grew up working on a farm in North Texas, and I guess has run other places, but is here. And probably the first thing you should order when you walk in is something called the redneck platter.
Which is?
It varies, but it's definitely the statement of purpose. There's country ham, Benton's country ham. It's my second or third favorite, but it's the most prized. That's sliced even more thinly than prosciutto. I mean, it's absolutely transparent. There's a mound of pimento cheese, beloved of Southern food freaks. I see you sticking out your tongue, Evan.
Don't say that. I had a bad encounter with pimento cheese as a child, so it's always lingered.
Are you sure it wasn't pickle and pimento loaf?
It could have been. I need to go back.
Let's all go visit your childhood. There are people who absolutely adore pimento cheese. Other people, it's a deal breaker. But as far as pimento cheeses go, this is good pimento cheese. There's the kind of devil eggs that you associate with small town funerals in the South. And pickles, all kinds of pickles.
Where's the biscuits?
Oh, yeah, biscuits. They think a lot about the biscuits. It's the super flaky kind rather than the tender kind. They are not the most tender biscuits you've ever had in your life, but they're highly good biscuits, especially when they're piled high with pimento cheese and country ham. And the pickles aren't pickles out of a jar. They're all different. I mean, some are, you know, barely salted, and some are lacto-fermented, like the turnips, and there are crisp cucumbers, and it's a bunch of different sournesses coming together as one thing. I'm not sure I've ever thought of a little ramekin of pickles as being a statement, but in this case, I think they are.
That's a good beginning into a dinner that could very quickly get pretty heavy.
Very heavy, in fact, because the other thing that you absolutely have to order is the hush puppies, cornmeal that's fried very crisp and it's very light and airy on the inside. And there's softened butter flavored with molasses in tiny little bottles of hot sauce that the chef makes himself.
We haven't even gotten to the, like, plates of food.
We haven't. I haven't talked about the guacamole, which some people think are great, or the egg salad.
Egg salad as like an appetizer?
Egg salad as an appetizer.
I love that.
With trout roe, so you know that it's serious Southern egg salad instead of just egg salad as filler.
Surely there is a lot of meat on this menu.
Well, given the kind of place it is, it would seem inevitable. There are sliders made with pork belly that's been cooked until it's super soft. That would have to be like one of the cliched dishes of the era, but somehow he pulls it off. There's like a aioli that tastes like red-eyed gravy. I wouldn't have thought it was possible.
Wow.
Coffee and ham fat, but it seems to work. They're very proud of their deer burgers, which is to say hamburgers made with big, crispy, black, but super rare inside venison.
Such a lean meat as venison, I wouldn't imagine in the form of a burger.
I'm not sure why it works. I mean, there's mayo on it. There's some more of that pimento cheese, which is inevitable. There's onion that's been cooked down. There's a lot of sort of sloppy, oily things on it, so you don't notice the dryness of it. You also don't notice the sort of funk of venison either, but it's not a bad dish. He's always cooked in Italian restaurants, and there is a smoked pork ragu. There's a lot of things that go over fire here, including the grilled quail, which is nice, and including smoked baby back ribs, which are distinctly not the kind that you'd expect from a barbecue place, but aren't bad. I think he smokes the bacon, that he wraps around elk loin. I always love that moment when the waiter says to you, "And how would you like your elk?"
Oh. So the Italian background explains the garlic bread on the menu.
Probably does. It's very much like a slightly elevated version of the garlic bread you would get at old-fashioned pizzerias. I mean, a lot of cheese on it.
It's really good.
Sometimes I find that I go there and I eat mostly vegetables, though, which...
Jonathan, that is a sentence that if I had told you 5 years ago, you would one day say, you would not believe me.
The vegetables are so good in Southern cooking. I mean, anybody can make a deer burger. And these aren't necessarily Southern vegetables, so they have, you know, braised collards. But I'm not sure I've ever been to a meat and threes and been offered seared maitake mushrooms with garlic or charred Romanesco. Charred Romanesco just doesn't really make it to North Texas that much.
That's true. But buttered turnips and radishes sound pretty good.
There's nothing the matter with that.
Is the Southern theme carried through to dessert?
Yeah, of course it is. I mean, you're going to look around. You're going to see all the art that's around you. And then you're probably going to go for a scoop of butter pecan ice cream, which is
so
great.
So good.
Or blackberry cobbler or a buttermilk biscuit with honey and a shot of milk.
Wow.
Even if you've already had the biscuits before, maybe you're going to want to have more biscuits.
That's Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. His recommendation, Manuela in the Arts District. I've got to try that redneck platter. Someone else can have my pimento cheese. Text the words good food to 69866 to get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. That's it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, you can listen to the show on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. You can also download the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, many thanks to the Good Food team. They are...
Abby Fentress-Swanson.
Laurel Garcia.
Joseph Stone.
Hey, Abby, here's mine. Camellia Say.
Joel Stein.
And Ronnie Mickelson.
And I'm Evan Kleiman. I'll be back next week with more Good Food.